You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I am Lindsay Ehrens. Let's go inside Utah politics. The Senate passing the big, beautiful bill, but there's concerns on both sides of the aisle that Congress hasn't worked out all the kinks yet. Now, it was a tight margin in the Senate, so much so that Vice President J.D. Vance had to step in and break a tie. The bill lost controversial provisions on selling public land and even its official title, thanks to a move by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. But cuts to programs like Medicaid and SNAP remain a sticking point for Democrats and even some Republicans.
Today's vote will haunt our Republican colleagues for years to come, as the American people see the damage that is done, as hospitals close, as people are laid off, as costs go up, as the debt increases.
Do I like this bill? No. Because I try to take care of Alaska's interests, but I know that in many parts of the country, there are Americans that are not going to be advantaged by this bill. I don't like that.
Well, the president has pledged not to cut Medicaid, now insisting that the current versions will only target waste, fraud, and abuse. The extensive editing, though, of the bill has left some people with questions about what it actually does to those programs at this point. So let's take a look at the Medicaid reforms. The Senate bill, like the House version, tightens up work requirements. Able-bodied adults younger than 65 would need to work 80 hours a month to be eligible. What's new is this. The Senate version restricts the fees that states can place on health care providers used to fund Medicaid and limits federal reimbursements. Now, that means that states would need to fill that funding shortfall themselves or limit their coverage. The Congressional Budget Office projects nearly 12 million people nationwide could lose coverage. Now, as for the SNAP benefits in the Senate bill, it cuts the program's federal budget by $186 billion through 2034. That's according to the CBO again. Now, states themselves, though, would have to make up either the shortfall on their end or narrow local eligibility. Now, SNAP would also see new work requirements similar to Medicaid. And I'm joined today by Gina Cornia. She is the executive director of Utahns Against Hunger. Gina, welcome to Inside Utah Politics. You deal with SNAP on a daily basis for Utahns here who are receiving food assistance. So how concerned are you about these potential cuts that are coming?
We are really very concerned, and we really like to call this the big betrayal bill. That it is really betraying the commitment that our country has made to make sure that everyone has access to food. In Utah, nearly 37 million people could lose their benefits, and that's just based on the expanded work requirements and the not allowing refugees, asylees, and victims of work and sex trafficking to access those benefits.
Will you repeat that number for me? How many Utahns will this
36,000.
36,000 Utahns who rely on these SNAP benefits. Again, we're talking just SNAP, not Medicaid necessarily.
Correct. I mean, the Medicaid number is 164,000, so that's a much bigger program. But the same people who access Medicaid are also folks who are accessing SNAP. And for example, you know, everyone really thinks that like work requirements are this new idea. And we've had work requirements in the SNAP program for decades. And they're raising the age from 18 to 55 to 18 to 64. So capturing those people from 55 to 64 is going to have a huge impact.
Yeah, talk to me about that impact. What does it mean for those folks in that age group?
So they'll have to meet the work requirements. And currently, states can exempt people for, you know, very good reasons, for not having someone to take care of their kids while they work, for not, you know, lacking transportation, or even a lack of jobs. And so this bill will curtail those kinds of exemptions, including exemptions for veterans, people experiencing homelessness, and kids who are aging out of foster care. States used to have, or currently have, a lot of flexibility in who is subject to those work requirements and who is not. And this is really eliminating a lot of the flexibility that states have to serve their communities.
It is, I think, really easy for groups like yours to paint a very dire picture of what could happen if these cuts are going into place, and especially if Utah doesn't make up the gap in any sort of way. Can you cut through the rhetoric a little bit for me on the impact here? Is it really as dire as it feels? Because the other side of the coin is saying, well, we need to make sure these taxes stay lower.
Well, if they were lowering taxes, I think that there would be an argument. But this would increase the incomes of the top 20% by 3.7%, but it would decrease the income of the bottom 20% by 3.8%. And so this is benefiting corporations and higher earners, and not only increasing or lowering the incomes of low-income folks, but it's taking away the safety net that allows them to work, that allows them to raise their families and have housing. I mean, it really is asking the most vulnerable in our communities to bear the burden of these tax cuts. And, you know, I would like nothing more than to be wrong about this, and that it isn't going to increase hunger and food insecurity. But food banks and food pantries are busier now than they were during the pandemic. With food prices increasing, that has driven more people to need help. And now with tariffs, the tariffs on aluminum, there was a story this morning about the tariffs on aluminum increasing the price of beer. Well, a lot of foods are packaged in aluminum and in, you know, like, steel, is that the right? So food prices are going to continue to go up when those tariffs go into place. And so it's just putting so much pressure on families who are already trying to make ends meet, and making it more difficult for them to qualify for benefits.
You work with these families on a daily basis. Do you think there is any room for so-called waste, fraud, and abuse to be cut out of these programs? How do we get at those people who are maybe taking advantage of the system, but not those people who really need these benefits?
Do you know, I mean, we get asked that a lot. And I mean, I've been doing this for 20 plus years. The number of people who I see sort of like scamming the system, I mean, there's always going to be scammers. There are always going to be people who work the system, and those people will still be able to work the system. It is the people without access to technology, without access to transportation, who can't jump through all the hoops that work requirements will require in order to maintain their eligibility. And it really is just paperwork. You know, I was talking to the eligibility director for SNAP the other day, and they were talking about how we used to require people to recertify every single month to prove that they were eligible every single month. And that's just a paperwork nightmare. And again, not everyone has access to technology. There are fewer Department of Workforce Services offices, so they're harder to get to, and if you have to hand in paperwork. So it's just, you know, creating a bureaucracy that makes it more difficult. And in terms of waste, fraud, and abuse, about 1% of food stamp benefits are trafficked. So not, you know, I mean, it's still too much. What is the bigger issue is this issue of skimming, where there are operations who are stealing people's benefits, and there's no way for those benefits to be restored. And so people just have to wait.
Yeah, I want to talk about a Utah-specific policy that we recently enacted, and that is we prohibited people who are using SNAP benefits from purchasing soda with their SNAP benefits. I want to take a look at the sponsor of that bill, Kristen Chevrier, and then House Speaker Mike Schultz discussing that.
Soda is the biggest expense for SNAP dollars, and it's also one of the least nutritious things.
Wait, back up. You just said soda is the biggest expense on the SNAP program. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
You're kidding me.
There are many reasons to remove it. One of those is that we're spending too many tax dollars on it, and the other one is that it's not providing any nutrition, and it is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
So is that true, that soda is the biggest expense on SNAP benefits?
So it's about 7% of every dollar, or 7 cents in every dollar that is spent on SNAP. The vast majority of people spend their SNAP benefits on staples like rice and beans and pasta, produce. I mean, all of those. I mean, if we really want to improve the healthy consumption of the food that people are buying with SNAP, we should increase benefits. It's only about $1.37 per person per meal a day, and so benefits are completely inadequate. You know, in our conversations with Representative Chevrier during the session about this bill, it was about the consumption of sugar and how unhealthy sugar is, and it's, you know, sugar is poison. Except that she took candy out of the bill. So it's not about sugar. And so...
So what is it about?
Well, in my opinion, it's about controlling what low-income people have access to. Yes, is sugar bad for us? Yes. Should we be drinking less soda? Yes. But we should turn that same focus on our legislators. Our legislators get paid with state tax dollars. Then maybe we should ban them from buying soda with their tax, with their legislative salary. I mean, it's in my opinion, it is an argument that people make to control what low-income people buy. They're not deserving of these things. They're poor, they're not working, but 85% of SNAP households have earned income, and so they're paying into the system too. And so, and it's, soda seems like a logical thing to, you know, to exclude from SNAP benefits, but it opens the door for other things to be banned as well. And that's our biggest concern, is where do you stop at healthy food?
Yeah.
You know, like, canned corn has sugar in it.
Yeah. Well, I'll propose your idea to the speaker next time if he wants his benefits to not be able to buy soda with his salary.
I mean, if soda is bad for us, then maybe we should create an environment at the legislature that does not encourage soda consumption.
I'm sure that's an idea they would willingly reject. Let's just put it that way. Gina Carino with Utah's Against Hunger. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks so
much. Thank you.
All right, still ahead here on Inside Utah Politics. The future of public education in Utah. We sit down with a familiar face taking over as state superintendent. Stay with us.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ahrens.
Well, the new face of Utah's education system should be a familiar one. State school board member Molly Hart took over as Utah's superintendent of public instruction. The Republican was first elected to represent Southeast Salt Lake County in 2022. She was picked by her fellow board members, though, to replace outgoing superintendent Sydney Dixon, who served in the role since 2016. Well, I'm joined today by Dr. Molly Hart. Welcome to Inside Utah Politics.
Glad to be here.
Yes. So first of all, how does it feel to be the new superintendent of Utah schools?
It is exciting and exhilarating and all the things all at once.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So talk to me about your vision. I mean, you're taking over from Sid Dixon, who has nothing but rave reviews, both from the board, from elected officials, from just members of the education community. It would appear you have big shoes to fill, but what's sort of your vision for the state's education system?
Sure, and we're in a great place, and Dr. Dixon left it in a just a fantastic place for all the changes that are on the horizon and possible for states as the federal government moves to a more state-central education systems. So my vision is to make sure that the legislature and the board and communities and LEAs and families are all working together for the best education system in the United States and in the world.
Yeah, when we say LEAs, that means local
education Education Agency.
That's the legislative speak for school districts,
yes.
Right?
And charters.
And charters, correct. So you mentioned those federal cuts that are coming.
Yes.
How is Utah going to be impacted by getting rid of the Department of Education nationally?
And all that remains to be seen, and there's a lot of talk. So nobody's really sure what that looks like. We know that there are some moves to change funding streams, but not a single policy has gone through Congress. So we don't know what it looks like. So we need to remain aware and vigilant, and we need to prepare. But that's not anything Utahns aren't used to doing.
Yeah. Do you have concerns right now about that federal money going away, and what are they?
Of course we have concerns, because any disruption to districts as they prepare for the next school year, as they go throughout the school year, districts have to have information over the summer in order to be ready. And once things get started, it's, you know, all steam ahead, full steam ahead. So I do worry. Of course I worry. However, Utah is a state that prepares and is conservative, and we've got some contingency plans to make it through this uncertain time. I'm staying on the calls, I'm staying up to date with the news. And what's important to note, especially about this most recent funding, is it was money that Congress appropriated previously. So it's not money, it's money that is already scheduled to come our way. It's a matter of when and how, and I look forward to when the decisions are made and that money actually gets to Utah. But we're in a good place right now. We just need to wait for decisions to be made at that federal level.
Yeah, so you're saying we'll have a little bit of runway, a heads up to know how it's going to impact
us. And we have a little bit of runway too here in Utah. So I know it's nerve-wracking, but at the same time, I also have confidence that Congress will move forward with it.
Interesting. Okay, so here locally, our education budgeting is what pays for all of our school districts, our teachers, right? Our tax dollars pay for these things.
Sure.
What would you like to see if you had a blank check, right, mm-hmm. for education? I know that's what you often go up and advocate for on Utah's Capitol Hill, but how would you like to see this system funded?
Sure. I would like there to be fewer strings attached, because strings cost money in and of themselves.
Give me an example of a string.
A string would be reports that need to be filed when perhaps the information is not necessarily used. Strings would be having a very narrow definition of what the money can be used for, rather than perhaps taking a wider view. We did some of this work with at-risk, the at-risk add-on money for our most at-risk students. We took some of those strings off. We need to continue down that road so that individual schools and districts can make decisions about, say, for instance, who's at risk in their communities. Mm. That's really hard to say outside of a community. That's really, those things are things that we really need to make sure that we've elected our local boards, and charters have their boards, and there's a reason that they exist, and they should be granted some flexibility to implement what their schools need the most.
One of the ways in which the legislature is considering changing public education is how it's funded, in
yes.
that some of our local property taxes mm-hmm. go to education funding.
Right.
The state wants to collect that at the state level and then kind of funnel it back out
sure.
to sort of what they
sure.
say equalize. How mm-hmm. do you feel about that plan?
The devil is always in the details. You never know until you see exactly what. Now, the way you describe it, where it just comes in and goes straight back out, that, that doesn't sound, or you've not said any of the specific details. I would be worried about the specific details.
And those details are how much do they give to certain schools and where?
Well, once they have it,
right.
then you can, it's a shorter leap to doing different things with it. Again, if you are keeping local dollars local, then that's the most flexibility possible. So a lot of those things, though, that's the legislature, and we'll deal with whatever that the legislature decides.
How do you work with the legislature and the conflicts that arise? We have seen some large regulations on K through 12 schools in the last few years, even down to the flag bill that we've got going on, kind of bubbling up in the headlines. What's your philosophy there?
We have to have open communication. We have to. We have a responsibility as we, meaning USBE, the board, the agency, the LEAs, the local education agencies, to explain what the second order effects are, to explain what happens when. Sometimes we don't do as good of a job as we need to, and then there's a misunderstanding or a not all the factors are known.
Sure.
So the best way is to be as completely transparent as possible and make sure that you're communicating if this, then this, and the different options. And sometimes problem solving, sometimes the question is, what problem are you trying to solve? Let me help. And working with legislators early and often helps, because working late, last minute, in the middle of session is not the time to solve problems.
And sometimes there's that disconnect between what my neighbor is experiencing and what the broader state is
experiencing. A problem of one is not a problem necessarily of many. And that's why it's important that USBE has the best data collection, data sharing, transparency, and scenario planning, you know, the what ifs.
In our final 30 seconds here, just talk to me about what's Utah's K through 12 schools doing well? What are we getting right?
Okay, I a very quick story. I didn't intend to stay in Utah. I'm from another state, and when we got here, we fell in love with the education system. I fell in love with the education system as both a parent and as a practitioner. We do a lot of things right. The over 90% of students go to school in Utah's public education system. We offer lots of choice. We offer lots of opportunities for students, and we're always looking for more. If you haven't been to a school to volunteer lately, that is what I suggest for your bucket list for the fall.
I went and did career day at my daughter's school. So
excellent.
They just talk
excellent.
About, you know.
And that is what we're doing right in Utah schools.
Yeah, very good. Dr. Molly Hart, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Utah's new superintendent of K-12 public schools. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, coming up on Inside Utah Politics, the president visiting alligator Alcatraz. What makes the Florida Ice Center so controversial? We've got that when we come back. Well, the controversial new alligator Alcatraz Immigration Detention Center hosted President Donald Trump for a visit this week. It's being highlighted as part of the Trump administration's ongoing immigration crackdown, but it's eliciting a lot of criticism, too. Our Washington correspondent, Hannah Brandt, has the details.
Deep in Florida's swampy Everglades, President Donald Trump toured a brand new detention facility built to house illegal immigrants.
It's known as Alligator Alcatraz, which is very appropriate because I looked outside and it's not a place I want to go hiking anytime soon.
The facility is expected to cost about $450 million per year, which will come from federal FEMA funding. And it's built to hold around 5,000 detainees, starting as soon as tomorrow.
Very soon, this facility will house some of the most menacing migrants, some of the most vicious people on the planet. We're surrounded by miles of treacherous swampland, and the only way out is really deportation.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says this is just the latest step in their larger mass deportation effort.
This facility is exactly what I want every single governor in this country to consider doing with us.
But Alligator Alcatraz is attracting criticism from lawmakers, human rights groups, and environmental advocates.
The Congressional Hispanic Caucus wrote in a post, "It's hurricane season, and all this administration can do is put more people in harm's way. Alligator Alcatraz is a sick political stunt."
Get out the way out of our Everglades!
Environmental advocates worry the site could harm the fragile Everglades ecosystem.
The habitat here needs to be preserved and taken care of.
Environmental groups did file a lawsuit to try to block further action at the facility, but the president brushed off those concerns.
I know you're taking a little heat from some environmental groups, but I take it all the time, and that's an honor.
Plus, the Trump administration is making the case that anyone in the U.S. illegally can avoid ending up at Alligator Alcatraz if they self-deport instead.
We'll buy their plane ticket, go home, and then they get the chance to come back legally.
In Washington, I'm Hannah Brandt.
Well, that's going to do it for today's Inside Utah Politics. Don't forget, if you have any local political stories you'd like to see, make sure to reach out. You can email me, insideutahpolitics@abc4.com. You can also follow along with me on social media. I'm on X, Blue Sky, Threads, Instagram. Just search for Lindsay on Air. You can also find our show online wherever you podcast. Just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ertz. Again, anywhere you get your podcasts. Well, thanks for being with us today, everyone. We will see you next week.